In the territory of Gabon, in French Equatorial Africa, 50 miles south of the equator, is the River Ogowe. And in that river is an island named Lamborini. The island has a population of about 2,000 natives and about 50 Europeans. One of the residents of Lamborini is a man who, to his dismay, has been called a living saint. He is an accomplished organist, philosopher, physician, and humanitarian. He is, of course, Dr. Albert Schweitzer.
Biography in sound. Tonight we bring you a portrait of one of the great men of the ages. To tell you about Dr. Albert Schweitzer, as they know him, will be his friends, relatives, co-workers, and acquaintances. Your host for this transcribed biography of Albert Schweitzer will be the editor of the Saturday Review, Norman Cousins. Mr. Cousins.
Albert Schweitzer came to Lamborini with his wife, Helen, in the summer of 1913. He was at that time 38 years old. He was already an ordained minister, a dedicated teacher, a famous organist, an authority on Bach and Goethe, a brilliant writer, and during the 8 years preceding his arrival in Africa, he had prepared himself for his mission by becoming a doctor. People ask, of course, why would such a man, at the height of his extraordinary creative powers, choose to bury himself in Africa? Some clue, perhaps, comes from a letter he wrote to an old friend in London shortly after his arrival in Lamborini. To Emil Mettler, he wrote,
"It was not easy for me to give up the two professorships at Strasbourg University and the career as an artist in music. For both, I have natural gifts, and therefore I had the natural tendency to follow the arguments of my friends that one should do that for which one is gifted and that one can do best. But through the Spirit of Jesus, I became conscious that a man can be called to a place without knowing exactly why he has been called to it. He would like to withdraw from his obedience, arguing that others would do better than he. Yet, this is the great mystery. The Spirit of Jesus commands, and we have to obey."
In Lamborini, Dr. Schweitzer set about building his hospital. The difficulties were staggering. The site had to be selected, labor recruited, water made safe to drink, buildings erected, and food provided for the patients. The patients began arriving as soon as they heard the settlement was to be a hospital. The work went forward until World War I.
I remember him coming to England after the First World War.
Emil Mettler.
Ill in health and burdened with debts. His first hospital went to pieces. It was destroyed by ants, whilst he and his wife were interned in a concentration camp. Dr. Schweitzer's purpose for coming to England consisted in giving organ recitals and lectures so as to enable him to collect the necessary funds wherewith to pay for those debts which he had incurred on that first expedition.
I met Dr. Schweitzer for the first time in 1928 in Berlin.
Madame Alice Ehlers, harpsichordist and professor of music at the University of Southern California.
I was then a student at the Hochschule für Musik in Berlin and mostly interested and concerned in playing Bach's music. So when Schweitzer came in 1928 to Berlin on one of his many travels to Europe, where he played the organ in order to make money for his hospital in Lamborini, I went to his lecture. I didn't know much about Lamborini then. I just was interested in the man who brought Bach to life for us. The younger generation had a different approach to Bach, and it was we all were inspired by Schweitzer's book on Bach. It was my Bible, I remember very well. So I went to this lecture hoping to get a personal impression of the man who wrote this book. After 10 minutes, I forgot about Bach, I forgot about the harpsichord, I forgot about everything. I was absolutely fascinated about the man who stood there on the stage and talked with the greatest simplicity about the work which he carried on since years in Africa. He talked about the hospital, about the difficulties they had and still have, his great love for those people who need his help. And everything was done so simple, so modest, so honest, that, as I said before, forgot about Bach. And my face must have expressed something of this kind, because a friend sitting next to me said, "Now, stop, don't tell me you will give up playing and will go as a nurse to Lambarene." He was right. This was exactly what I felt. After the lecture, Dr. Schweitzer, in his very kind way, asked the audience to join him in a very simple restaurant where everyone could go and could afford to pay a meal. I went, of course, and sat modestly on a table where I could look at him all the time. I remember how astonished I was when suddenly one of his secretaries came and said, "Are you Alice Ehlers? The doctor wants to meet you." And I felt like a very, very young child. And I think I behaved a little bit like this too. I went to his table and he took out of his pocket a little notebook, which he always carries with him. And on this notebook was, "When in Berlin, want to meet Alice Ehlers. I am interested in her most unusual programs and the quality of the program." This is how I met Dr. Albert Schweitzer. He is not what you would call a brilliant man, nor a witty man, but everything he says comes out of a deep concentration, of a deep philosophy, of the highest ethics I've ever heard expressed by any man. And he lives these ethics, as you all know who are acquainted with his life. I have met many great men and many important men, but probably I've never met a greater man than Albert Schweitzer. He is so humble, he is so honest, he is so modest, that you just feel you are a better person yourself if you are allowed to stay near to him.
On his second journey to Africa, Albert Schweitzer was able to rebuild his hospital. This time he selected a site a few miles from the ruins of the first settlement. As they had on the first occasion, the natives brought him their sick, and he ministered to them. Finally, the doctor himself became ill, and for reasons of health, he reluctantly left Lambrini and returned to Gunsbach. Dr. Julius Bixler, president of Colby College, recalls,
"I first saw Dr. Schweitzer in the fall of 1928. I was spending the winter in Germany. President Lowell of Harvard had asked me to find out whether Dr. Schweitzer was in Europe, and if so, to ask him to come and give the Lowell lectures in Boston. So I wrote to Dr. Albert Schweitzer, care of the Goethe House in Frankfurt, asking if I could come to see him, and soon had a very cordial letter from Mrs. Schweitzer asking me to visit them up in their Highland home, high up in the Black Forest. It was a tiny town named Königsfeld. I went there and walked down the one street of the town, and I remember very vividly the thrill that came over me as I saw coming down from the other end of the street this rather shaggy, hulking figure of a man with a very casual manner, very casual air, but at the same time with a suggestion of great vigor, a man with a sort of a massive frame, one who you thought could wrestle with the soil as well as with the problems of the mind and the spirit. Dr. Schweitzer was cordiality itself to this completely unknown American who had come to see him, but one could observe that even at that time he was besieged by a great many people. His secretary told me that he received letters from all over the world from people begging him for a chance to go out with him to Africa. These people who wrote obviously felt that their own spiritual tangles would be solved if they could work with a person like that. I was also able to observe a little of the way in which his prodigious activity carried him on from one type of work to another. Instead of resting, he would turn from music to medicine, to metaphysics. One very amusing thing happened when we'd been talking on some philosophical topic, and all of a sudden he turned to me and said, "Now let's have a little yachts." Well, of course, I was trying in my halting German to carry on the conversation and to put up as bold a front as I could, but I could not think what the word yachts meant. It didn't seem to me I'd ever heard that word before. But not wanting to spoil the temper of the occasion, I said, "Yes, of course, this is just the time for yachts. I usually have my yachts about now." So he said, "All right," and we walked into the next room. And then he sat down at the piano and started to play, and a great light dawned on me. Of course, yachts is J-A-Z-Z, jazz. So he played me what he thought was a form of American jazz, though I must say I don't think it was quite as effective as some of his work on the organ.
In spite of the phenomenal demands made on his time, Schweitzer was still able to keep up with his writing. To his revolutionary quest for the historical Jesus, he added his great philosophical work, The Philosophy of Civilization. Later, he wrote an account of his work in Africa called On the Edge of the Primeval Forest. In 1929, he published a partial autobiography, Out of My Life and Thought. Occasionally, he would have to return to Europe, but always, his thoughts were with his patients and his hospital. We may ask, exactly what is it that Schweitzer has carved out of the African wilderness, carved with his own two hands and his burning desire? What is Lamborghini really like? Robert G. McGregor, American Consul General, speaking from his post in Leopoldville, Belgian Congo, recalls a visit to Dr. Schweitzer's hospital.
"Any worries, cares, selfish thoughts, or ideas of self-importance drop away for no perceptible reason. One notices simple things, and although there is much activity, there is no haste. Although there is purpose, there is no grimness. Although there are different races, there is none of that contrast one meets with in the other Africas. There is no obsequious deference from black to white. There is instead trust, faith, and naturalness. I had heard much criticism of the unsanitary conditions and disorderliness among the Africans prevailing in the hospital area. I suppose this is true, if one holds it up to the mirror of modern Western standards. But the important thing is the service that is being rendered to the African. To him and his family, the shelter of the hospital and the simplicity with which the patient is treated, in accordance with the manner of his previous living, makes him feel welcome and does not frighten him away back into the bush after a brief brush with Western man and methods. The primitive African patient brings his possessions with him, a cooking pot, one or two chickens sometimes, and other items. He knows that if he left them behind in his village, he would not find them when he returns, and moreover, no one would know about them. All day long, African canoes come and leave, bringing and burying away the sick and cured. As is well known, the African brings his whole family, and they cook for him and look after him until he is well. Thus, in moving about in the hospital area, one sees rows of square enclosures, which are the sick patient's rooms. Invariably, the patient is on the floor rather than on the bed, and always his family is camped in an adjoining protected area, busy over the cooking pot, heated over charcoal, or tending children who skip about happily in the mud or dirt. There is an air of quiet assurance and contentment in the area of the hospital building which must be reassuring to the soul. This, as the medical world will acknowledge, is often instrumental in curing the ills of the body. We were shown into the operating room, which was immaculately clean, and where a recently unpacked high-power electrical lamp was suspended over the operating table. We were shown the surgical instruments, all clean and properly in order, in a closet near the operating table. Adjoining was a sterilizing room, where water was being constantly heated in a pressure boiler.
In these confused and puzzling years, some of us, I suppose, are apt to ask, what's in it for me? Generally before embarking on any new venture. Dr. Schweitzer is an exceptional person, and this question has probably never crossed his mind. But what reward does Lambrini offer Schweitzer? Dr. Carl Menninger of the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas, after meeting Schweitzer, observed,
I was very much impressed in his saying that, for example, that even some of the natives whom he had trained for long periods to perform certain tasks, and indeed sometimes they did it quite well under supervision, but they could not be relied upon to carry on these tasks once the eye of his authority was turned away, so to speak. It brought home to me vividly how reconciled this great man is to working for the work's sake and for what he believes the work represents. It's difficult enough for most people to conceive of giving up all the ordinary compensations of our civilized life and for the compensations of our labor, the secondary though they may be, material reward, barter value, prestige, and so forth. But it's even more difficult to imagine a sustained, self-sacrificial work of this kind being carried on without a hope either of gratitude on the one hand or of a permanent character alteration in the person worked on the other. The privations and discomforts, the loneliness, the unpleasant climate, these and other difficulties are often mentioned. But to think of a man working for people who are essentially children, and very young children at that, and children who learn very slowly, if at all, children who see no necessity for expressing permanent gratitude, this seems to me Herculean.
By what reasoning does a man arrive at the conviction that it is his duty to repay mankind for the richness of his first 30 years? Why did Schweitzer go to Africa? What simply is his philosophy of life? We ask that question of Dr. Julius Bixler.
You catch the cue to his philosophy in the title of his autobiography, Out of My Life and Thought. Those two words, life and thought, suggest the two strains which are so dominant in European philosophy. Life, on the one hand, the emphasis of the people like Nietzsche, whom we call the vitalists, those who say that the driving, dynamic impulses, the emotions, the romantic instincts and feelings are the important things. And thought, of course, stands for the people we call the philosophical idealists. That is, the people who say mind or idea is the one important thing and everything else in the world depends on mind for its existence. Now, these two schools of thought have always been at odds with each other, but in Dr. Schweitzer, they come together in a remarkable way. But if you ask Dr. Schweitzer why it was that he went to Africa, he says, well, it's perfectly simple. The black man has suffered from his supposed brother, the white man, long enough. Now the white man has developed the science of medicine, and in simple justice, he should share his discoveries with his black brother whom he's exploited so long. Now, if I feel this, he says, I ought to follow it out myself and not leave it to someone else. In other words, it's justice plus compassion. Justice representing thought, the abstract forms of thought, the notion of equality, and compassion representing life and the life that wills to live and finds that it develops into the will to love. It is these two things that sent him to Africa. And I like to think of him in Africa as one who represents not only the synthesis between life and thought, not only the synthesis between theory and practice, philosophy and medicine, and particularly perhaps the synthesis between faith and doubt, which is such a difficult one to arrive at. But I like to think of him as representing the synthesis for which our age above all else is striving, the synthesis of the different creeds, the different nations, the different sects, because here he is, a German Alsatian in a French mission with a wife of Jewish descent, ministering to the natives in darkest Africa. with nurses and doctors from various countries of Europe, supported by money from all the countries of Europe and from America as well. In the light of an example like that, who can say today that internationalism is an impossible ideal?
Friends of Albert Schweitzer in America had often invited him to visit this country, but he had never been able to spare the time. It was not until 1949 when he was invited to address the Goethe Bicentennial Convocation and music festival at Aspen, Colorado, that Schweitzer visited the United States. His very good friend, Dr. Emory Ross, treasurer of the Albert Schweitzer Fellowship, was on hand to meet him.
He landed here in July of 1949 on the new Holland-American line, the New Amsterdam, which was really new then. And after we got off the ship, we came through the Lincoln Tunnel. And as we stopped pay the toll, he said, you pay toll? And I said, why, yes. He said, I thought this was a modern city. He said, we had a bridge over the Rhine at Strasbourg years ago when I was a young man, and we paid toll over that. But he says, we've gotten rid of that. The bridge is free now. And he says, and you're still paying toll here. He had written before he came over here that he would like to be at home to his friends in America, in our home. He was going to stay with us, and if we could manage it. And he suggested that we have tea on four successive afternoons from 2 to 7 p.m. Well, we wrote back and said that that July in New York is very hot, and that people in New York don't go to tea ordinarily at 2 o'clock, and if they go, they don't stay till 7, that those hours were a little long. But he wrote and said, well, now in London and in Paris and in Copenhagen and in Stockholm and in Rome, I have had tea in the homes of my friends from 2 to 7. And he said, I should think that it would be the same in New York. Well, we wrote back again and protested a little bit, but said that also that he'd want to be having dinner, and if the teas ran till 7, then make dinner very late and so on. So then he answered that and said, well, I propose a compromise. He said, suppose we make it from 2 to 6:30. And so we had the teas from 2 to 6:30. There were 387 people who came and signed the guest book on those four afternoons. And he stood for approximately 5 hours each afternoon talking with every person that was there. And then in his humbleness, it really seems to hurt him when people refer to him as the greatest man in the world. Now, about the first instance I recall in America where he was featured in a national magazine was in Life magazine in November of 1947, when the pictures of Dr. Charles Joy and Melvin Arnold, who had been out in Lambrini, were published with a little letterpress under them. And in that, it said something to the effect that many people feel that he is the greatest man in the world. Well, somebody sent him clippings of that life story, and presently I got a long letter from him. And most of the letter was devoted to his pain that anybody would refer to him as the greatest man in the world. He said, in French as he was writing, he said, who knows but God who the greatest man in the world is? Nobody knows. It may be somebody that the world has scarcely heard of at all. And he said, certainly I'm not the greatest man in the world.
The week spent in Aspen was a notable one. To pay homage to the great doctor came all the distinguished men and women of medicine, art, government, music, and literature. Schweitzer lectured on Goethe once in German and once in French. We are fortunate to have a portion of his speech in French. The interpreter is Dr. Emory Ross.
Une autre particularité réside dans le fait qu'il ne s'exprime pas dans le langage pathétique, chargé de sonorité, usant des miroitements d'adjectifs nombreux et variés, mais dans le langage simple et sobre de tous les jours, qu'il s'est élevé au rang de langage poétique.
Another special quality lies in the fact that he does not express himself in solemn language, laden with sonorities and the glitter of copious adjectives,
but in the simple, sober language of everyday life, which he knows how to lift to the rank of poetry. Characteristic also is the rhythm of his poems.
Le rythme de la phrase d'ordinaire chez lui n'est pas façonné d'après celui du maître du vers.
The rhythm of his phrase is usually not fashioned like the meter of verse.
Il se trouve en tension avec lui.
It is even in tension with the latter.
En cela, il existe une sorte de parenté entre Goethe et Bach.
In this, there exists a kind of affinity between Goethe and Bach.
Careful precautions were taken by the authorities at Aspen to keep him protected from the very many people who wanted to meet him.
Again, Dr. Carl Menninger.
After his speech, an effort was made to hurry him out of the back entrance to a waiting car. But a young woman in the front row reached him before his escorts did and handed him her program for an autograph. His sponsors urged him not to start such a precedent, telling him that it would absorb his waning strength and limited time, too. A crowd had already gathered about him, waving their programs and their books, and he turned to his friends and said, "For some strange reason, they want me to write my name for them. Surely that isn't much for me to do. I'm glad to do it." And for over an hour, he smilingly complied. Such an episode might be interpreted to indicate that Schweitzer is not the humble, modest man that some have described him, but one who gets a good deal of pleasure out of the acclaim and popularity of people. This was not my impression at all. It was obvious that he got pleasure out of the fact that people wanted him to do something that he could do. He seems to really live what he says he believes in, joy in serving. A surgical operation in Africa, an autograph in Aspen, or the rendition of a Bach toccata in London. I should still describe him as a shy man, shy and gentle and rather slow-moving, but very alert. In view of his enormous gifts, to say nothing of his sudden worldwide popularity, his humility and modesty are outstanding.
After giving the Goethe lectures at Aspen, Dr. Schweitzer returned to the East. The distinguished organist, E. Powell Biggs, recalls,
"In the summer of 1949, on his way back from Aspen, Dr. Schweitzer honored us in Boston by visiting the city for 2 or 3 days. We took him around to play quite a number of organs, and I had written to him in Europe before he came to invite him to play on the radio, but he had replied that he was coming here to lecture and he wouldn't have time to practice and so on. But the interesting and rather amusing thing was that when we took him around to play various organs in Boston, he was so delighted, he took such a pleasure in playing music on them that we could hardly peel him off the organ bench to get him to go on to lunch or to the next organ. One of the things that an organist learns from Dr. Schweitzer, I think, is that he must always remain a student. Obviously, Dr. Schweitzer for years has been a student. Bach distilled the music of his predecessors and created something of his own out of it. And in a way, Dr. Schweitzer has taken the thoughts of Spitta and other authorities on Bach, and he has clarified them, elaborated them, organized them, translated them. And in other words, he has, and of course, added ideas of his own, and he has brought these ideas to a great public, to a worldwide public, really. He has made us realize many things about Bach that we didn't know before. We couldn't enjoy Bach, we couldn't play Bach, and understand Bach today as we do without Dr. Schweitzer. He has pointed out the pictorial aspect of Bach's writing, the firm bass depicting firm faith, the shifting scale passages perhaps signifying drifting mists and the waves of the sea and the bells. There are many bell figures in Bach. Of course, they're perhaps rather obvious. But there are many more subtle things. And from reading Schweitzer's books, you come to understand Bach the poet a great deal more. Of course, I don't believe you ever come to the end of Bach. Another thing that he has clarified is the art of organ building. He emphasizes 4 items, 4 basic items that are the root of good organ design. He notes, 1, open placement of the organ. And then he notes the design of the wind chest and the necessity of low wind pressure. And then he says that the only action to have is tracker action. And I'd like to add to that the comment by the eminent Cleveland organ builder Walter Holtkamp that tracker actions are for fingers with a purpose. That's a very good comment. And then Dr. Schweitzer, in his biography, speaks about the organ specification, and he says that this must be based on the classic models of the 18th century.
Scholar, musician, philosopher, doctor, missionary, Schweitzer is also a husband, a father, and a grandfather, although he saw his four grandchildren for the first time in 1949. From Mondorf, a small village outside Zurich, here is the voice of Schweitzer's daughter, Rena.
I am Rena Eckert, the only child of Dr. Schweitzer, and I'm living in Menedorf, a little village on the lake of Zurich, where my husband is working as an organ builder. We have four children and five dogs. I was born in Strasbourg as a birthday present for the 44th birthday of my father. He had already founded his hospital in Lambarene, and during my childhood, I didn't see very much of him. He has been a lot of time in Africa, and when he was home with my mother and me, he was always busy working on his writing, his conferences, and his organ recitals. I think that our family life was a little bit different from that of other people, but in spite of his long absences, my father really tried very hard to give us as much of a family life as he could. He even took the time to give me piano lessons, and we shared, and still do, a common love of the music of Bach. During my early childhood, my mother made the sacrifice to stay with me in Europe, but as soon as I was grown up, she spent as much time as her health permitted her with my father in Lambarene. I don't see much of my father here in Menedorf because he still doesn't find time for family visits. But we go to see him in Günzbach, in the village in Alsace, where he spent his childhood and where he relaxes and sees his friends when he is in Europe. Günzbach is a paradise for our children. There they sometimes can go for a walk with their grandfather. He asks them about school and is very understanding about their problems. Four children, of course, make a lot of noise, and what always amazes me is that my father is never bothered by it, even when they take turns at the piano from morning to evening. With my father being such a confirmed musician, music really is his best relaxation, and my husband being so closely connected with organs and organ music, it is only natural that music is an important part of our life. And that goes for the children too. I have three girls, 16, 13, and 9 years old, and a boy of 15. As I said, they all play the piano. Christian, my girl of 13, already preferred the music of Bach. We could perhaps see if we can get her to play something. Christian! Willst du etwas für uns spielen? Bitte!
Was?
Schweitzer has received honorary degrees from universities in many European countries and in America. But in 1952, he received a very great honor indeed. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Speaking from Dublin, Ireland, his biographer, George Seva, tells how Schweitzer received this news.
When news of the award of the Nobel Peace Prize reached him 2 years ago, he was busily engaged in cleaning out the pens of his pet antelopes. On hearing it, he made no remark, but went on with his work. A few days afterwards, however, when telegrams and letters of congratulation began to pour in by the sackful, he was heard to murmur, "Well, if this is fame, I just as soon it was posthumous." But for him, it came also as the fulfillment of a long-cherished dream. He could now, at long last, in the evening of his life, build his leper hospital on enduring foundations. Not until the end of last year, however, could he go to Norway to receive the award. And when he did so, the magnitude and enthusiasm of his welcome was equaled only by that given by the Norwegians many years ago to their own countryman, Nansen. On the last night of his visit to Oslo, after a week of hectic activity, he had to make an appearance on the balcony of the City Hall before an immense crowd. As he stood there, visibly moved, utterly exhausted, he said one word only to the crowd. The Norwegians have not forgotten what they suffered at the hands of the Germans in the war, and Dr. Schweitzer had given his address in French. But the last word that he spoke to them was, "Auf Wiedersehen," and the comment that a friend overheard was this: "When Dr. Schweitzer says, 'Auf Wiedersehen,' it sounds like a benediction."
For several years now, a film based on Albert Schweitzer's life has been in preparation. It will be released to the public sometime in 1956. The producer of the film, Mr. Jerome Hill, has already recorded for the past 5 years many of Dr. Schweitzer's organ performances released on records. Disturbed over the amount of Dr. Schweitzer's time consumed in making the film, Mr. Hill reports,
"Finally, after we'd been working on this film for the third and then the fourth year, and we were almost into our fifth year, I felt rather apologetic about it to Dr. Schweitzer. I felt we were taking too much of his time, because when he did give us time, he gave us whole days. Because when he did give us time, he gave us whole days completely sacrificed to us. And I reminded him that we'd been so long on it. He said that that made no difference. That as far as he could see, that was the way to do a thing well. And he, to illustrate his point, he told us about his mother's father, who was ordering a pipe organ for the church. And he brought all the technicians in and the organ builders and the workmen and sat them around and gave them the specifications and told them what he wanted. And then he said, 'Now, I want this to be a very beautiful instrument.' And he said, 'I don't want to catch anybody hurrying.' But very far back in the early days, when we'd first arrived in Gunsbach, we wanted to give him an idea of the kind of sound that we were prepared to make of his organ playing and of his voice when he was with his family and his friends there in Gunsbach. And we brought the sound truck up to his house, parked it far enough away so they couldn't hear the motor, and brought the microphone into the room where he was practicing the piano. And when he practiced, he would be also posing at the same time for a portrait bust that the German sculptor Fritz Behn was making of him. This was the only time when he was anywhere near quiet, and Behn profited by these hours to be there drawing him. So he improvised a little scene, a little lecture on Bach, which he gave to Fritz Behn, and illustrated his point with passages on the piano. And he made the point to Behn that Bach was first and foremost a violinist, and that he thought of melody violinistically, that the melody should be phrased as if they were bowed. And this little piece of film here, this piece of soundtrack, was made at that time.
Das Wichtigste. Und das, was mir so immer mehr aufgeht, das ist, dass Bach eigentlich nicht für ein Tasteninstrument schreibt, sondern alles ist gedacht wie für Violine.
Photographer Eric Anderson is also the co-author with Eugene Exman of The World of Albert Schweitzer. This bestseller, published last year, has since been translated into 8 languages. Mrs. Anderson is also associated with Mr. Jerome Hill in the making of the documentary film already mentioned. After an extended visit with Dr. Schweitzer in Europe, Mrs. Anderson has been back in this country only a few days.
My association with Dr. Schweitzer enabled me to be with him in Africa at his hospital, as well as in Europe when he came to spend a few months during the summer in Günzbach in Alsace. Since I had to load quite a heavy equipment with me, film cameras and photographic cameras, I had my car with me. He really doesn't enjoy to ride in a car. In fact, I think the one vehicle he still enjoys is the little train in Günzbach, which he knows so well from his childhood. But finally, he found out that in the car he could be undisturbed by people, and many times he has been sitting next to me, writing on his scripts. And then, for the first time, when I really found out that he had taken to the car, it was when he said to me, "This car feels like a cradle. The American cars do ride more softly. I can ride in it." But the peace didn't last very long, because whenever he saw someone walking in our direction, he would say, "Erica, stop. We have to do a good deed." And he would ask the people where they were going and shove them into the car. So we had sometimes peasants who would be on their way home with their tools they would use in the fields, or musicians with their musical instruments, or school children. And I remember many episodes in which the conversation between Dr. Schweitzer and the people we picked up became, to me, a great source of joy, and also to the people he picked up, who sometimes recognized him and sometimes didn't know who the nice old gentleman was. We picked up an old lady, peasant woman, and she didn't seem to recognize the face, but she looked at Dr. Schweitzer and she said, "I must have seen your face in the paper somewhere." And then she said, "Oh, I know it's Dr. Schweitzer, it's the good doctor. We are so happy that you are one of us." She lives a few miles away from his own village. When she got out of the car, she said, "Dr. Schweitzer, I'm going to a pilgrimage in a few weeks, and I'm going to pray for you." And then she said, "No, I think I'll pray for the lady who is driving the car, because you don't need it."
This past October, Schweitzer journeyed quietly to London, where he had been invited by Queen Elizabeth to be invested with the exclusive Order of Merit. As a non-Briton, Schweitzer became the Order's second living honorary member, the other non-Briton being Dwight D. Eisenhower. Dr. Schweitzer passed up the fancy hotels put at his disposal, choosing to spend his time in London with his old Swiss friend, Emil Mettler.
When he came to London to receive from the Queen the insignia of the Order of Merit, I fetched him at Folkestone, the port of debarkation. At Victoria Station, the car of the French ambassador was ready, waiting to bring us to a York Mansions restaurant in Westminster. There he made his headquarters, staying with me for a full week. As soon as the public got to know he was there, the telephone started ringing almost incessantly. People came to see him in the homely setting of a private room where he worked at a large writing table from early morning till late in the night. At times there were long queues, people from all walks of life. One morning early we paid a visit to the home of an industrialist in Eaton Place. I wanted to show the doctor a portrait of his, which an artist some 2 years ago was commissioned to do, life-size of Schweitzer, although the artist never met his subject. But he came to ask me if I would lend him some 24 photographs for this purpose. Then, from each one of them, he would draw the best features of Schweitzer. It was an astoundingly good portrait in wonderful colors. When Schweitzer saw it, he was amazed to see it hung on the wall in the large and beautiful drawing room. Afterwards, our host led us into the basement to view another remarkable life-size portrait which the same artist had done from the best photographs of Churchill. What? Exclaimed Schweitzer. I hanging on the wall up in the salon and Churchill down in the basement? At once change the pictures round.
On this same visit to London, Dr. Schweitzer had an opportunity to visit with his old friend, Clement C. Chesterman, the chairman of the British Council of the Schweitzer Hospital Fund.
The visit to Buckingham Palace was for him a most memorable experience. I hope that Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth told him why she was awarding him the Honorary Order of Merit, for he wouldn't know himself. Perhaps she did, as they sat by the fireside after the ceremony and talked about the hospital and Bach's music. What a good woman, he remarked, as we lunched later at the French Embassy. Sunday was spent in writing his thank you letters and in autographing piles of presentation copies of his various books. Prince Charles and Princess Anne got one each. I know because I took them. And so did my grandson, with the inscription, Dear Andrew, during your whole life, let your heart speak to you as it has in your childhood.
The way in which Dr. Schweitzer was made to feel at home in the presence of the Queen moved Dr. Schweitzer intensely. On Monday morning, the 24th of October, after accompanying him to pay a courtesy visit to the Archbishop of Canterbury, we left by car for Dover. It was a glorious autumn day, and the doctor, full of humor, I'll soon go back to Africa into a tropical sun. When shall we see each other again? In any case, as he said before, if ever I should fall into the hands of cannibals, I hope they will write the following epitaph on my tombstone. We have eaten Dr. Schweitzer, and he was good to the end.
We all wonder, who love him so dearly, when he will feel to stop his work. He's going to be 81 on January 14th. But I have not heard a word, and I think he will never retire. As long as heaven gives him the strength to carry on, he will carry on, because Lambarene is his life and his love.
The greatness of Schweitzer, indeed the essence of Schweitzer, is the man as symbol. It is not so much what he has done for others, but what others have done because of him and the power of his example. This is the measure of the man. What has come out of his life and thought is the kind of inspiration that can animate a generation. He has supplied a working demonstration of reverence for life. He represents enduring proof that we need not torment ourselves about the nature of human purpose. Thus, his main achievement is a simple one. He has been willing to make the ultimate sacrifice for a moral principle. Like Gandhi, the power of his appeal has been in renunciation. And because he has been able to feel a supreme identification with other human beings, he has exerted a greater force than millions of armed men on the march. It is unimportant whether we call Schweitzer a great religious figure or a great moral figure or a great philosopher. It suffices that his words and works are known. It suffices that he is loved and has influence, because he enables men to discover mercy in themselves.